Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Our show today is titled, There is Nothing New Under the Sun. And if you don't believe me, we've got Noam Chomsky and Chris Hedges making pretty much the same point. I hope you'll stay tuned. Public school made me hate the study of history. I think it did so on purpose, because the less people know and care about historical events, the more they will accept the propaganda and lies that the ruling elite dispenses to keep the people pacified and obedient. Did I just say that? I'm starting to sound like a radical in my old age, aren't I? Back in my school days, I was better behaved. In the history I was taught, historical figures were all plaster saints. The United States government never did anything wrong. We students learned nothing about the relentless extermination of the Indians, almost nothing about the country's wars of conquest, nothing about the horrors of the Industrial Revolution, or about the growth of corporate capitalist power. And underlying everything we were told was the theme of progress. Schoolbook history showed that society was getting better, life was getting better for everybody, everybody was getting richer and better educated, and working less hard, and having more leisure and better food. Americans especially, but also people of all the nations who embraced progress and democracy and supported freedom rather than communist totalitarianism. We learned that all of America's wars were honorable and necessary. Spain forced us to go to war in 1898, just as Germany forced us in 1914. Left alone, we're a very peaceable nation, we were taught. When we students were not simply being brainwashed, our heads were being stuffed with historical facts that had very little connection with our lives. So I had to memorize the years in office of every president and the names of his vice presidents. I won't say this knowledge is useless. It's not bad to know that William McKinley came after Abraham Lincoln and before John F. Kennedy. But the facts that we memorized were not made relevant to our own experience either. Just academic drudgery. Now at the time, this was the mid-1960s, at the time the Vietnam War was really getting underway. It would have been interesting indeed to study the earlier U.S. invasion, jungle guerrilla warfare, quagmire, and eventual conquest of the Philippines. But to do so might have prompted us to question the current U.S. invasion, jungle guerrilla warfare, and quagmire in Vietnam. The American Legion and the Chamber of Commerce, and hence the school board, would never have stood for it. Studying the past intelligently might make you question current policies. But the purpose of history in schools is to get you to accept current policies, to support them, not to question them. So the long U.S. war against the Philippines was never mentioned in history class. Not even glossed over. Simply ignored. That war was started by William McKinley, by the way, president from 1897 to 1901. Vice presidents were Garrett A. Hobart and Theodore Roosevelt. In recent years, I've been reading history with great interest. I've been reading real history, not schoolbook propaganda history. And from this reading, a couple large lessons are inescapable. One is that, contrary to the schoolbooks, U.S. foreign and domestic policy has never strictly adhered to Christ's teachings in the Sermon on the Mount. Another large lesson is that the myth of progress is a false and pernicious myth. Taking that a step further, we might even say that not only is there no progress, there is nothing new under the sun. That's not really an original observation, is it? Which proves the point. Just recently, I came across some nice talks by Noam Chomsky and by Chris Hedges. In a way, each is about there being nothing new in this solar system. And we'll hear parts of them today. Let's start with Chomsky. He's doing a question and answer in March 2011. Back then, all America was excited about the so-called Arab Spring, and especially the massive peaceful demonstrations in Egypt that in fact brought down the dictator Mubarak. This did get extensive coverage in the U.S. press. in part because the U.S. government was quite willing for Mubarak to move on and be replaced by a younger, healthier dictator who would do our bidding without all the bad baggage that Mubarak was carrying. Chomsky makes the point that the so-called Arab Spring, massive, peaceful, popular revolts by Middle Eastern people against their country's dictatorships, the Arab Spring did not begin in Cairo's Tahrir Square or in Tunisia a few months before that. It has been happening for years. More often than not, the many pro-democracy demonstrations have been brutally suppressed by the country's dictators with U.S. backing. In fact, this happened right in Egypt, months before Tahrir Square, and it happened in Bahrain right afterwards, all without making a ripple in the U.S. media. So there was nothing new about the so-called Arab Spring, says Chomsky. The Arab peoples have been demanding democracy, and not getting any, for many years. For over a century, in fact. Sort of like the American people, only more so. Here's Noam Chomsky on the Egyptian uprising of January 2011.
I certainly didn't anticipate anything that was going to happen in the Arab world. So yes, it changed my opinion in that respect. It was unexpected. On the other hand, when you look back at it, it's not that different from what's happened before, except that in the past, the uprisings were brutally suppressed. And indeed, they were this time, too. So the first of the uprisings was actually in November. That was in the Western Sahara, which is occupied by Morocco. 25 years ago, Morocco invaded. It's violated UN resolutions. It's a brutal occupation. In November, there was a nonviolent protest, which Moroccan troops came in and crushed violently, as they've been doing for 25 years. It was serious enough so that it was brought to the UN for a potential inquiry, but France intervened. France is the primary protector of atrocities and crimes in Western Africa. It's the old French possessions. So they blocked any UN inquiry. That was the first. The next one was in Tunisia, again, more or less French area. And you know, there were scandals, as you know. I think the Minister of Tourism or one of the ministers went for a vacation right in the middle of the uprising and got some bad publicity. But that one was successful. It threw out the dictator. Then came Egypt, which is the most important because of its significance in the Arab world. And that was pretty remarkable. It was a remarkable display of courage, dedication, commitment. It did succeed in getting rid of the dictator. It hasn't yet changed the regime. Maybe it will. But the regime is pretty much in place, different names. But it's nothing new. That uprising, the January 25th uprising, it was led by young people who call themselves the April 6th movement. Well, April 6th hasn't, for a reason. April 6th, they picked the name because it was the date of a major strike action a couple of years earlier at the Mahalla textile complex, big industrial complex. There was supposed to be a major strike, support activities and so on. Well, they were crushed by violence. That's April 6th, and that's only one of a series. Incidentally, shortly after the crushing of the April 6th uprising, President Obama came to Egypt to deliver his famous address, outreach to the Muslim world and so on. On his way, he was asked at a press conference whether he would say anything about the authoritarian government of President Mubarak. And he said, no, he wouldn't. He said, Mubarak's a good man. He's doing good things. He's keeping stability, like crushing the April 6th strike and so on. So that's just fine. Then the uprisings went beyond. The most striking one is Bahrain. That's frightening to the West. First of all, because Bahrain hosts the Fifth Fleet, the major military force in the region, U.S. fleet. Second, because it's largely Shia. And it's right across a causeway from eastern Saudi Arabia, which is majority Shiite. It happens to be where all the most of the oil is. Now that gets frightening. For years, Western planners have been concerned about a kind of a geographical and historical accident. Most of the world's oil is in Shiite areas, right around that part of the Gulf, Iran, southern Iraq, and eastern Saudi Arabia. Well, if the uprising in Bahrain spreads to Saudi Arabia, then Western power is really in trouble. And in fact, Obama has changed the rhetoric that's used officially for the talk about the uprisings. For a while, it was regime change. Incidentally, that's after the uprising succeeded. Then you kind of move in and say, oh, it's fine. Now it's regime alteration. We don't want any change. It's too valuable to have our dictators run things. Actually, a rather striking fact about all of this is take a look at the WikiLeaks exposures. It's pretty interesting. The ones that got the most exposure in the West, the big headlines, euphoric commentary, were the leaks from the ambassadors, which said that the Arab world supports us against Iran. Well, one thing was missing in that reaction in the newspapers by the columnists and others, namely Arab opinion. What they meant was the Arab dictators support us. Now, what about Arab opinion? It's known, but it's not reported. In the United States, zero. There's, I think, one report in England. Jonathan Steele reported it. Probably nothing in France. I don't know. But it's well known. Western U.S. polling agencies, released by very prestigious agencies. It turns out that some Arabs think Iran is a threat, about 10%. A majority, a vast majority, think the major threat is the United States and Israel. In Egypt, 90% say the United States is the major threat. In fact, opposition to U.S. policy is so strong that in Egypt, I think it's close to 80% think the region would be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons. Over the whole region, it's a majority. Well, who cares? You know, going back to John Berger's term, democracy, Western intellectual contempt for democracy is so profound and deep-seated that it doesn't even occur to anyone to ask, well, what do Arabs think when we are euphoric that the Arabs support us? Well, the answer is it doesn't matter. As long as they're quiet and subdued and controlled, as long as there's what's called stability, it doesn't matter what they think. The dictators support us, period. We're euphoric. Well, okay, that kind of ties together a number of these questions, but going back to Amir Haas's comments, what's happened should lead us to think about what has been happening, not only in the Arab world, but elsewhere, has often arisen and has been subdued by violence. And that's been true for a century. I mean, the British were suppressing democracy movements in Iran over a century ago. In Iraq, there was a Shiite uprising, and as soon as the British cobbled the country together after the First World War, big uprising, violently suppressed. One of the first uses of aircraft to attack civilians. In fact, Britain was very proud of that. The famous Lloyd George, Britain succeeded in blocking a disarmament conference in 1932. They prevented it from barring use of aircraft against civilians. Lloyd George, famous Lloyd George, wrote in his diary that this was a great thing because we have to reserve the right to bomb niggers. So therefore it was a very good thing that the British government did. And it continued. In 1953, the United States and Britain combined to throw out the parliamentary government in Iran. In 1936 to 39, there was an Arab uprising in Palestine against the British, violently crushed. The First Intifada was, again, a very significant popular uprising, almost entirely nonviolent, and a real popular movement. Women's groups protests against the feudal structure, try to dismantle it, and so on. It was crushed by violence. So sure, these things like this happen all the time. They're just crushed. What's unusual this time is that strong enough so it was in most of the countries able to sustain itself. What will happen in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, Jordan, we don't know. In fact, we really don't know what will happen in Egypt. The military has so far retained control, and the top military command, at least, is deeply embedded into the old oppressive regime. They own a lot of the economy. They were the beneficiaries of the Mubarak dictatorship. They're not going to give it up easily. So it remains to be seen what happens there.
Amazing. He did that off the top of his head. Amir Ahas asked him a question, and he replied with a brilliant 10-minute lecture on the history of popular rebellions in the Middle East, which, it turns out, are nothing new, nor is their suppression by U.S.-backed dictators. You're listening to New World Notes, and our theme today is There is Nothing New Under the Sun. On to Chris Hedges. Hedges is one of our more eloquent prophets of gloom, doom, and the threat of American fascism. Just a few weeks ago, he talked with Seattle radio host Mike McCormick, and we'll hear some of what he had to say. Hedges has been active in the Occupy Wall Street movement. Like most other OWSers, he believes that the corporate capitalist bigwigs are doing their best to destroy democracy, plunder the planet, destroy the environment, rule the world, and enrich themselves by impoverishing everyone else, all with the help of the U.S. government. I happen to think this is correct. For Hedges, though, there's not much new here. Maybe what's new is how close they have now come to succeeding 100%. There's nothing new about their project, though. That's a couple hundred years old. And Hedges cites historical parallels that most of us know little about, such as the Iroquois Confederation, the Philippines War, there it is again, the early days of the Russian Revolution, Weimar Germany, the collapse of communism in East Germany, and the destruction of Yugoslavia by U.S. and its European allies. Whew! No wonder they don't want us to know any real history. Here's Chris Hedges.
So talk a bit about your latest book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. What was the motivation in...
Well, it's a look at the sacrifice zones, those places within the country that have been offered up to unfettered capitalism, to the marketplace, where there are no impediments to what corporate profiteers want. We began with Pine Ridge, which of course is where it all started, the seizure of Native American land by railroad barons and timber companies and gold speculators, who of course in the process carried out egregious acts of genocide. That whole sort of demented project of exploiting human beings and the natural world until exhaustion or collapse took place on the Western Plains. And of course, that whole concept of manifest destiny, which is that God has given the Anglo-Saxon race the right to seize for themselves resources, land, and push aside any impediments, including human beings who stand in their way. Once westward expansion was complete, that imperial project went first to the Philippines, into Central America. I mean, it of course is continuing to this day in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think what's also important about that moment in history is that it didn't just seize land, exploit, and often exhaust resources from buffalo herds to virgin timber, but it destroyed a competing ethic, another way to relate to the natural world and relate to each other. In native societies, people who hoarded goods for themselves were despised. Everything was communal. And Marx and Engels, when they write on communism, interestingly enough, look very, very closely at the social and political structures of the Iroquois Indians. And I think in some ways that sort of project of unfettered capitalist expansion couldn't subsist with that competing ethic. And now that whole project is crashing down upon us, that these sacrifice zones, we go on and look at our former manufacturing centers in Camden, New Jersey in particular, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States and not surprisingly one of the most dangerous. The coal fields of southern West Virginia, where we are allowing coal companies to literally destroy the Appalachian mountain range, by blowing the top 400 feet off of mountains, leaving behind a vast wasteland. We flew over it, hundreds of thousands of acres. It's just insane because these coal companies, to save money, don't want to dig down as they did in the past to extract the coal. They will just destroy the mountains, expose the coal seams, use some of the largest land equipment on Earth, 25-story drag lines, giant bulldozers. And one of the things they do is they use these massive machines to push the topsoil and the forests over the sides of the mountains, and then they burn them. So we're flying over the Appalachians, and we're seeing these man-made fires where they're just burning off the forests, and there's nothing left behind. Now, they also poison the water, the air, the soil. They leave these gigantic billion-gallon toxic impoundment ponds filled with heavy metals, which occasionally burst. It is just a perfect window of how we, of course, across the planet, have allowed corporate power to determine our relationship to the ecosystem that sustains the human species. And in theological terms, these corporations are systems of death. They are not about preserving, nurturing, or protecting life, including the environment that makes life for us possible. And that's why the environmental crisis is intimately twinned with the economic crisis. We also go into the produce fields of the country, where undocumented workers are often treated literally like slaves, held against their will in debt peonage, sometimes behind barbed wire, forced to work, told that if they report the abuse to authorities, their families in Mexico or Honduras or Guatemala will be harmed. As Bernie Sanders says of Immokalee, where we were in the race to the bottom that has become America, Immokalee is the bottom. And that is the perfect worker in the eyes of the corporate state. What we are creating nationally as well as globally with globalization is a form of neo-feudalism, a world of masters and serfs, where workers are told that in order to be competitive in a global marketplace, they are going to have to be competitive with the prison labor in China or sweatshop workers in Bangladesh who make 22 cents an hour. That's what's being created. These corporations are supranational. They have no loyalty to the nation state. They are quite willing to hollow the country out from the inside, which they're doing. The signs of physical decay are everywhere, collapsing infrastructure, closing public schools, closing libraries, closing fire departments, and then the long-term suffering that is being visited on the working and increasingly the middle class. Roughly 20% of Americans are either underemployed, seriously underemployed, or unemployed. And the corporate state knows one word, which is more. There are no limits, and some great political theorists, including Karl Marx, have written about this, that unfettered capitalism is a revolutionary force. Karl Polanyi, an economist, in 1944 wrote a book about unfettered capitalism called The Great Transformation, in which he noted that quality of commodifying everything, commodifying human beings, commodifying the natural world. And he actually, although he is an economist, writes that when a society loses the capacity for the sacred, when nothing has an intrinsic value, but simply a monetary value, then built into that system is a quality of collective suicide, because you know no limits. And that is precisely where we are, as anyone who reads climate change reports, as I do. Nature magazine this month had a very terrifying piece where they interviewed 16 of the top climate scientists who talked about global, worldwide, catastrophic, ecological collapse. And if we don't wrest power back from these corporations, which in essence have carried out a kind of corporate coup d'etat in this country in slow motion, they'll kill us, quite literally. And so I am certain that there will be a response. I don't know what it will look like. I covered movements and revolutions and insurgencies around the world, Eastern Europe, the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic, the two Palestinian uprisings or intifadas. And I learned that these forces have a kind of mysterious quality, but the engine that drives popular unrest is the actions of the ruling elite, of the ruling class. And because they have not responded to the legitimate grievances and sufferings of American citizens, tens of millions of American citizens, then I am utterly certain that we've not seen the end of this. Will it be called Occupy? Will it look like Occupy? I don't know. And we are not immune to seeing this backlash become a very frightening right-wing backlash. The right-wing populism of the 1930s created some very frightening and deformed movements. And in essence, what we live with is a political system that has become utterly paralyzed. It doesn't function in a sense that it doesn't function on behalf of the citizenry, and that doesn't matter whether it's Republican or Democrat. And that's a very perilous state to be in. I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, and it was that political paralysis, that inability on the part of the traditional elites to cope with a deteriorating economic situation. And the war in Yugoslavia was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. It was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia, led to the vomiting up of some very frightening people, Radovan Karadzic in Bosnia, Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia, and Franjo Tuđman in Croatia. And we could very well see, especially with the global financial community once again teetering on the brink of collapse, some very terrifying distortions. I mean, the Tea Party, which channels, I think, a legitimate rage and a legitimate sense of betrayal, focuses that anger in the way fascist movements do on the most vulnerable rather than on the elites. And it is bankrolled by, I think, the most retrograde forces in American society, including the Koch brothers and others. And that's exactly what happened with the Nazi Party. It was bankrolled by the German industrialists, and Germany's problems were the fault of homosexuals and Jews and gypsies and the mentally ill and liberals in Berlin and intellectuals. And the Tea Party, like all fascist movements, speaks in the language of violence, celebrates the gun culture, targets the weak and the vulnerable, in this case Muslims, undocumented workers, feminists, again homosexuals, intellectuals, liberals, they have a long list, feminists. And I don't take movements like that lightly, however much we may laugh them off, because I know that when societies disintegrate, and there is a widespread revulsion at traditional structures of power, there are always very large elements within that society who seek vengeance, and they seek that vengeance through movements like that. So one of the reasons I have been such an active supporter of the Occupy movement is because I don't want to see us go the other way, and of course I want our resistance to be nonviolent.
Chris Hedges, ending up our show on the theme, there is nothing new under the sun. If the U.S. media actually informed the people about what was happening, and if schools actually taught real history instead of patriotic brainwashing, there's another phrase we'd hear more of, and that is, here we go again. Mike McCormick's half-hour interview with Chris Hedges is available, and you'll find a link to it on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks to Mike and to his show, Mind Over Matters. And thanks to you for listening. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, and, as Claude Coburn advised, never believe anything until you've read the official denial. Ciao.